Kenyans. We want to grow our economy.
Yes.
We want peace in our country.
Yes.
We want jobs.
Yes.
Jobs. Jobs.
Well, we hear lots of enthusiasm in the crowd there, at least. What about more broadly in the country?
And that is it, Steve. Zimbabweans have lost their fear. That is so important. Every time I've come here, people will talk to you, but not out in the open. Now they are speaking out. And you heard the supporters agreeing with Emmerson Mnangagwa, but then there are plenty of Zimbabweans who don't back him. Listen, for example, to Godfrey Mwazwe.
At least there's hope of a better future, even though I am still suspicious of what is going to happen since we are still in there. Nothing is still clear. I mean, everything is still dark for now.
There's still uncertainty.
Yeah, there's still a whole lot of uncertainty in the view for the future, because the very same people, the suspicious people, it's just a change of hands.
He says the very same people in power, well, there was an opposition to the ruling party. Are they seeing this as a real change?
Not yet. It's much too early. And many people are asking, is the opposition going to be included? We have had the ZANU-PF party ruling us for 37 years. We need true change. Is Emmerson Mnangagwa, who now finishes former President Mugabe's term of office until election scheduled next year by latest September 2018, are they going to show that they want all Zimbabweans to be involved? Is Emmerson Mnangagwa going to include the opposition? And even maybe Joyce Mujuru, who was a former vice president as well before him, who was also kicked out of the party. Are all these people going to be included? That is a question that we don't know the answer to yet.
What's happening now to former President Mugabe?
Very quiet, since he had to be pushed with the threat of an impeachment out of office. But there is a photograph of former President Mugabe, the First Lady Grace Mugabe. And of course, she is seen as having been the liability of the president because she was so ambitious and wanted to become vice president. There's a photo of them with three people behind them. Somebody from Central Intelligence, we're told, the former head of the Reserve Bank. And they're looking a little glum. They are looking a little glum, but we don't know whether they're going to decide to stay in Zimbabwe or move. Zimbabweans are very kind people. We're even hearing that the authorities are prepared to grant Mugabe immunity from prosecution as part of his resignation and retirement deal. They are not so keen on the First Lady, but people are speaking out, Steve. That is what you really notice. They're saying what is on their mind, and they're saying we're not going to put up with this sort of misrule where the economy has been ruined, where health service, education, you name it, potholes in the street, we want change now.
NPR's Afebio Quist-Arkton is in Zimbabwe, where a new president is to be sworn in tomorrow. Afebio, always a pleasure talking with you.
Always a pleasure to speak to you, Steve. It's extraordinary to be in this new Zimbabwe, as they're calling it. Quite a change. Quite a change.
When members of Congress come back from Thanksgiving break, they will start thinking about the 2018 elections. In elections earlier this month, Democrats made big gains, even bigger than they were expecting. So is a blue wave forming? NPR's national political correspondent Mara Liasson takes a look.
In Virginia, the results were stunning. The liberal base was energized. The Democrats' 2008 coalition, educated suburbanites, millennials, and single women, turned out in ways they hadn't for many cycles. But if the Democrats' goal is to take back the House and limit their losses in the Senate, they need to figure out whether they can replicate their Virginia win.
They ought to take everything that they've seen in Virginia with a grain of salt.
Linda Tran is a Democratic strategist.
Virginia is a very special part of the country. Its proximity to D.C. and this kind of beltway bubble mentality is something that shouldn't be underestimated.
In other words, voters in Virginia, particularly Northern Virginia, focus on Washington and on Donald Trump in ways voters in other states just don't. Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg points out there were also important limits to the Democrats' big gains in Virginia.
You still have the fact that working class voters and non-metro voters in Virginia did not move to the Democrats beyond where Trump was in 2016. That vote was stable. But obviously, Democrats can't get the kind of win they need to have a real majority, both nationally and in states, unless they build beyond the suburbs, beyond the metro areas, and reach those voters.
One way Democrats can reach those voters is to stick to bread and butter issues. Health care was the top concern for Virginia voters. Democrats are also hoping to run against the Republican tax bill, which is seen by many voters as favoring the wealthy more than the middle class. But there are other obstacles Democrats have to overcome. California Congressman Ro Khanna points to the mighty fortress of redistricting that Republicans have erected for themselves, drawing congressional and legislative district lines that make it harder for Democrats to win. And Khanna says in many states, it's getting harder to vote.
It's a huge obstacle. I mean, in terms of not having early polling places, not allowing same-day registration, not allowing so many people to come and vote who didn't have IDs. And that's likely to continue. So we need to fight that. And gerrymandering makes it very difficult. We've got to win districts that have partisan advantage by a few points for Republicans.
A combination of Democratic voters clustering inefficiently in urban areas, plus all those safely drawn Republican districts, means that Democrats have to win way more than 50% of the national vote for the House of Representatives in order to get 50% of the seats. To find out whether those structural advantages are enough to protect Republicans from a Democratic wave if one crashes ashore, I call GOP pollster Glenn Bolger.
When you look forward to 2018, what are you telling Republicans?
That we should not be looking forward to 2018. Look, off-year elections have been very difficult for the party in power, and Republicans control everything, and typically the party that is out of power makes significant pickups.
Historically, when a president's approval rating drops below 50%, the party in the White House loses an average of 40 seats in the House. This year, most Republicans in the House have safe seats, says Bolger.
But anybody who represents a suburban seat should be very worried after Virginia. I think that they are. And anybody who represents a seat won by Hillary Clinton in 2016 ought to be worried as well.
If the Democrats' task for 2018 is to come up with a message to reach white working-class voters, the Republicans' task, says Bolger, starts with governing.
The best thing that can happen for Republicans is to pass legislation like tax reform and get things done, as opposed to kind of getting bogged down on sideshows like Twitter. It is something that more and more people see is not presidential, and ultimately that could end up hurting him and Republicans.
Donald Trump and his Twitter feed loom over the 2018 elections, and there's nothing Republicans can do about that. Midterm elections are often reactions against the president and the party in power. That's what happened to Barack Obama and the Democrats in 2010 and 2014. And President Trump has yet to prove how he helps Republicans when he's not on the ballot. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 8:18, and you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Throughout the day, WPR brings you music and stories for Thanksgiving. Morning classics will include highlights from the Wisconsin School Music Association Honors Concerts. At 1, Giving Thanks features classical music and stories for Thanksgiving. You can find out more about all of our upcoming holiday specials at WPR.org/holidays.
Support comes from Kenosha Winter Harbor Market, featuring Wanda's Warmwares, scarves in a variety of colors and styles, including cowl, infinity, skinny, and more. Each item is handcrafted. The market is open Saturdays at the Rodie from 10 until 2.
WPR is proud to promote enriching and engaging communities. More information at rchs.us.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Ships and planes from at least a dozen nations, including the U.S., Britain, and Brazil, are now involved in the search for an Argentine Navy submarine in the South Atlantic. It's been missing for a week with 44 crew members aboard. Texas Congressman Joe Barton is apologizing for a nude photo of him that's been circulating on social media. NPR's Maggie Penman has more on the 68-year-old Republican lawmaker.
In a statement, Representative Barton said the photo had been sent to a woman he was in a consensual relationship with while separated from his second wife. According to a report by the Washington Post, the congressman threatened to report the woman to the Capitol Police when their relationship ended if any explicit materials were to become public.
Barton and his second wife divorced in 2015. A new survey finds 3 out of 4 Americans will do some shopping over the Thanksgiving holiday weekend. As NPR's Alina Selyuk reports, tomorrow is Black Friday.
Deloitte found that most people who say they plan to shop on actual Thanksgiving Day say they're doing it to chase down the best deals. Phil Dangler, who tracks Black Friday trends for the website bestblackfriday.com, says his survey found that most Americans actually think negatively about stores that open on Thanksgiving. But he says he does not expect major stores to stop opening on Thanksgiving because if your competitor is doing it, you can't afford to let them dominate the day.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:20. I'm Rachel Vasquez. Wisconsin's opening weekend gun deer harvest was down 12% compared to last year. Rich Kramer reports.
Wisconsin hunters took home nearly 14,000 fewer deer last weekend than they did in the first days of the 2016 gun hunt. The numbers are preliminary and only offer a snapshot of the total deer hunting season, which runs until Sunday. Department of Natural Resources big game ecologist Kevin Wallenfang says there are many factors that play into the opening weekend harvest, including weather.
As you went further north, deer harvest seemed to be more on par with what we had last year. I talked to plenty of hunters down here in southern Wisconsin that said they were soaked to the skin and headed for home by 9 o'clock in the morning.
Wallenfang says he expects the total deer harvest to be on par or slightly ahead of last year. License sales and deer harvests have been declining since the early 2000s. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Ballots for 2 open Wisconsin legislative seats are still taking shape. The deadline for filing nomination papers in the 10th Senate District, 58th Assembly District, and the 66th Assembly District came earlier this week, with a total of 14 candidates filing papers by the deadline. The State Elections Commission was still checking the candidates' paperwork as of yesterday. In the Senate race, the commission disqualified Ken Reimer for not having enough valid signatures. The commission gave Libertarian Brian Correa until tomorrow to obtain at least 7 signatures to get to the required 400. This is WPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology with support for Listening to the Universe, a virtual reality documentary on the discovery of gravitational waves, online at with.in. From Right at Home, working to improve the quality of life for seniors and people with disabilities by providing in-home care services, including rides to the doctor. The right care, right at home. Learn more at rightathome.net/NPR. From the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King. And if your family is a family that fights about politics, and really, in 2017, what family isn't, Thanksgiving can be tough. And now, one of the few ways we have to escape politics, sports, has become political. There is, of course, this controversy in the NFL over players kneeling in protest during the national anthem. So what do we do about all this? Sports commentator Pablo Torre is here to try and help. He's in our New York studios. Hey, Pablo.
Hey, Noel.
Do you have any tips on how to talk about football this Thanksgiving without it getting political?
So football this Thanksgiving reminds me of that game that kids play called Operation, if you're familiar with it, where you can pull out the misbehaving body part, and in this case, that would be the actual sports at the center of sports, but the proximity to the danger of politics is shorter and more dangerous, really, than ever before if you're trying to keep a happy household. So, for instance, if you're looking at this Chargers-Cowboys game, you can talk about Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, feuding with Roger Goodell and the NFL. This is something we haven't really seen before, but if you dig any deeper into why Jerry Jones is feuding with the NFL and why his Cowboys are struggling, you get into stuff like not just a domestic violence investigation into their star running back, Ezekiel Elliott, but also Jerry Jones enlisting, allegedly, Papa John's to basically put their thumb on the scale and say, you know, these protests that we're seeing really aren't something that's good for our business. So you can get to the football, just realize you're about a centimeter away from opening up a can of worms that is truly and explicitly political.
I'm going to go ahead and say millimeter, but okay. You think we've hit a point in 2017 where we can talk about any sports without them getting into politics?
I mean, if you're going to Thanksgiving and you want to talk about the NBA, for instance, there are some great stories. The Boston Celtics have won a lot of games in a row. The Philadelphia 76ers have gone from the laughingstock of the league to potentially a contender, at least in the Eastern Conference. However, if you're looking to talk about what we're all talking about in reality, you're talking about the fact that Donald Trump is feuding with LeVar Ball, the father of Lonzo Ball, the Lakers' star rookie. You're talking about, yes, how LeBron James just came out in support of Colin Kaepernick and called the president, of course, a bum on Twitter. So you can do it. It's just that the literal biggest names in the sport are the ones who are refusing to stay in their own silo.
You know, my brother is a huge football fan, and I called him earlier this week, and I said, listen, on Thanksgiving, would you rather watch football or would you rather talk politics? And he said, oh, no, I would rather talk politics.
I don't think those are going to be two different options, ultimately. I mean, think about just putting on the game and then seeing the national anthem being shown on screen. Like, that was once, admittedly, naively, seen as an apolitical moment. And I would say, if you're looking to have a conversation at the Thanksgiving table and replicate some of the fun of old sports conversations, you're probably going to retreat into that warm hearth that is debating whether steroid users can get into the Baseball Hall of Fame. Like, that's one of those controversies that's evergreen, but also somehow full of rancor without being actually sensitive to people's worldviews.
Evergreen. I like that. Pablo Torre is a senior writer for ESPN. Thanks so much, Pablo.
Thank you, Noel.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Okay, as holiday shoppers look for bargains this season, big retailers are also looking for a bargain of sorts.
Yeah, companies like Target and Lowe's want to keep their tax bills down, and they do this with something called the dark store theory.
What? Well, Sevilla Mann, a member station WMUK, is here to explain.
Here's how it works. Similar to homeowners paying tax on their house, stores pay taxes on their buildings. If a store thinks its tax bill's too big, it can appeal, but it has to justify the lower rate. One method to appraise a property is to use comparables, essentially comparing properties like yours. If you can find a store that's paying lower taxes, your appeal might succeed. And if you're a big box retailer, you might want to compare yourself to a dark or vacant store, like this one near Kalamazoo. I'm standing in the parking lot of a former Menards hardware store. The company closed this box a couple years ago and opened a bigger one across town. The facade's a blank, the parking lot's empty. There's a couple lights on inside, but otherwise it's pretty dark.
Well, first, there really is no dark store theory.
That's Linda Terrell, a tax attorney in Kansas, who argues that the term is a misnomer and based on a misunderstanding of how property is assessed. Terrell says there's nothing strange about comparing empty stores to open ones. Property tax is about the building, not what's inside it, no matter how well the owner's doing.
If I win the lottery, the value of my house doesn't change.
Terrell says it shouldn't matter if the store is dark or not. Dave Maturin disagrees. He's a Michigan state lawmaker who says it's not that a store is dark, but why it's dark that's a problem. Maybe it's the location. The vacant store sits in the part of town that shoppers have abandoned, while the new store appeals its taxes from the hottest corner.
Certainly the person that decided to shell out, you know, $15 to $20 million wasn't doing it foolishly, and they had a good idea that this was a good spot and a good structure to put in place.
But Maturin says this is mostly about deed restrictions. He says when a retailer quits a store, it's often just moving down the road and doesn't want a competitor to move into its empty space. Maturin says those restrictions make this real estate hard to sell.
And the deed restrictions may say you can't sell food, you can't sell clothing, you can't sell garden equipment.
He says it's simply not comparable to a store with no restrictions. Bexar County, Texas, the home of San Antonio, faced a tax appeal from hardware chain Lowe's. Chief appraiser Michael Amosquita says Lowe's lost that appeal, but had it been successful, other stores would surely have piled on.
Target would have been in line, Best Buy would have been in line, Sears would have been in line, local grocery chains would have been in line, Home Depot would have been in line. And then it would have, I think, would have spread to other categories of property,
causing a steep drop in revenue.
We anticipated in the two-year period we'd have lost $850 million.
Across the country, numerous tax challenges by big box retailers have been granted. And in many communities, battles over tax revenue from these retailers will likely continue. For NPR News, I'm Savella Mann in Kalamazoo.
This is NPR News.
This Thanksgiving Day, for the third year in a row, I get to choose and speak with an artist that I'm thankful for.
Happy Thanksgiving. Happy American Thanksgiving, we like to say.
Then they get to pick an artist they are thankful for.
Like she's living the life I could have lived.
I'm Ari Shapiro. Four artists share gratitude with fellow musicians this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 today with WPR's Brady Carlson on Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio.
You're listening to Morning Edition on WPR, and still to come this hour, Amazon and Walmart each want to sell groceries as part of their plan to sell everyone everything. So now Walmart is inventing new kinds of foods to lure customers into the store. NPR's Planet Money team has more in 15 minutes. Good morning. It's 8:30. I'm Rachel Vasquez in for Maureen McCollum. In Wisconsin news, hundreds of thousands of Wisconsin residents will take to the roads for Thanksgiving. AAA Wisconsin projects more than 945,000 people taking road trips this year. That's a more than 3% increase over last year's numbers. David Pabst of the State Department of Transportation says major road construction projects are finished for the year, so holiday drivers won't have to contend with lane closures or traffic barrels, but he says they will need to stay alert.
Thanksgiving, of course, is a huge family holiday, and people are driving back to their loved ones and whatnot, but also in Wisconsin, we have deer hunting going on, so there's a lot of extra traffic from that.
Papp says traffic crashes often increase in November and December, along with inclement weather and less daylight. The state's 511 service now offers weather information along with updates on road projects and hazards. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says an invasive fish species has been found in the Wisconsin River. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that four bighead carp captured near the Prairie du Sac Dam are the latest sign of Asian carp presence in the state. The department also found a fifth fish dead on the shore. You're listening to WPR News.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from many small businesses. This Saturday is Small Business Saturday, a day that encourages shopping and dining at local businesses. WPR is proud of the support we receive from small businesses across the state.
Support for WGTD's Radio Theater comes from the Lake Lawn Resort in Delavan, a full-service leisure getaway, family retreat, and meeting facility. Lake Lawn Resort, a proud supporter of WGTD's Radio Theater. LakeLawnResort.com.
It'll be a sunny Thanksgiving day across Wisconsin with some light winds throughout the day. Highs will be in the low 30s to mid-40s.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, who believes a modern approach to wealth management starts with asking questions and providing straightforward answers. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com. From the Melville Charitable Trust, driven by one goal, ending homelessness for good. Learn more online at melvilletrust.org and on Twitter at Melville Trust. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noel King. And just about 2 weeks ago now, Lebanese Prime Minister Saad al-Hariri said he was stepping down. He announced this, oddly, in a televised address from Saudi Arabia, which made a lot of people wonder why. Hariri suggested that Iranian meddling in his country was part of the reason, and that raised concerns about this intensifying rivalry between Saudi Arabia and Iran, with Lebanon caught in the middle. Well, Hariri is now back in Beirut, and he says he is unresigning. NPR's Ruth Sherlock joins us now from Beirut. Hi, Ruth.
Hello.
So, Ruth, just a lot going on here. Why did Hariri unresign?
Well, he said he had a change of heart after he met the Lebanese president, who begged him to stay on. He said, you know, at least wait to resign until we have enough time to have a dialogue and try to resolve the issues that made you want to quit in the first place. But diplomats I've spoken with, and it's widely believed now that Saudi forced him to resign, and that his return is really a way for everybody to save face, that the Saudis were kind of shocked by the international backlash. You know, the US and France and various European countries said, you know, this won't do, we need to have Hariri back. And so they're trying to ease him back in and sort of move on.
Lebanon is not an uncomplicated country, to put it mildly.
Right.
I'm wondering, that what is the response from ordinary people on the street? What are Lebanese saying about all this?
So, well, yesterday I went to Hariri's residence where he was speaking for the first time, and there was a huge crowd gathered. Here's what they sounded like. And so his supporters are delighted. They were shouting and screaming. And what's interesting about his speech as well, one of the reasons they were so delighted, is that his speech was sort of more conciliatory than before. So when he resigned from Saudi Arabia, he attacked Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is now part of the Lebanese government. And there's been this sort of fragile coalition government under Hariri. But if he'd left, the fear was that the government would collapse and that there might even be war here. So with him back, and with him talking now about trying to kind of bring everybody together, there's a profound sense of relief here. Here's what one lady I spoke with said. So yeah, so she's telling me that she feels secure, and that now that Hariri's back, she hopes that there can be unity in this country. And it's not so much Hariri himself as what he represents, this coalition, this kind of government that's trying to keep Lebanon together. But she did say, Saad is life for us. So it's a very important moment for Lebanese people here.
What about the people who don't like Saad al-Hariri very much?
Yes, well, you know, that's the thing. This is a country that has a lot of conflict. You know, there's different factions supporting different people, and it's now being torn apart by Saudi Arabia and Iran, and it's caught in this regional power struggle. The issue here is that all the same problems that caused Saudi Arabia, if they did fact coerce Hariri to resign, still remain. So whilst they may have averted the situation at the moment, you know, the country is far from secure in the long run.
Well, we're glad you're covering it for us. NPR's Ruth Sherlock, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
The United States is in a time that gets many people thinking about Winston Churchill. You know, he was Britain's prime minister at the worst moments of World War II, the darkest hour, as he called it. And regardless of their politics, some Americans feel we're in a dark time now. Churchill is the subject of some well-timed studies, a book about Churchill by Tom Ricks, a movie out today starring Gary Oldman, and a town in Missouri is highlighting its special connection to Churchill. Here's Alex Hoyer of St. Louis Public Radio.
Following victory in World War II, Winston Churchill's party lost an election and he was forced to resign as prime minister. One of the many invitations Churchill received was to give a lecture at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, and it included a remarkable postscript.
This is a wonderful school in my home state. Hope you can do it. If you come, I will introduce you, Harry S. Truman.
That's Timothy Riley, who heads the National Churchill Museum at the college. The small liberal arts school is about 100 miles west of St. Louis, and in 1946 had only 212 students. Riley says Churchill accepted the invitation to deliver what became one of the iconic speeches of the 20th century, known as the Iron Curtain speech that foreshadowed the Cold War.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an iron curtain has descended across the continent.
15 years later, college leaders wanted to pay tribute to Churchill and his connection to their school, and did something most unusual. They acquired the stones from a church in central London that was heavily damaged by the German Luftwaffe during the war. Traditional music from a pipe organ fills St. Mary the Virgin Aldermanbury Church, originally built in London in the 12th century. There are only 13 rows of pews, including a center aisle. The altar and pulpit have intricate wood carvings, beautiful chandeliers hang from the ceiling, and are adorned with brass pineapples, a signature design element of the church's architect, Christopher Wren. Wren redesigned this church and more than 50 others in London, including St. Paul's Cathedral, after they were destroyed in the Great Fire in 1666. Riley says St. Mary's and Churchill have a lot in common.
It was knocked down twice and rebuilt, like Churchill in his career, his long and storied career. But he always persevered. He kept coming back.
To get the church to the United States, workers shipped 700 tons of stone to Virginia. It then went by rail to St. Louis before being trucked to Fulton. Recently, a group of high school students were touring the church and museum. Their teacher, Sandra Schaefer, says her students love that they're able to visit a place with such a strong historical link.
It comes alive for them. They can see it, they can touch it. They have a visual in front of them, and for me, it seems that the paying attention, they get more out of it because they'll remember more.
Mita Young works at the museum here and considers it more than a job.
It's become a passion. It just gets to your heart. There hasn't been a great leader like Churchill.
And his perseverance is reinforced here by a centuries-old church that also persevered, making its way stone by stone from central London to the middle of Missouri. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hoyer.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
And it is 8:41. Good morning, and thanks for being with us on this Thanksgiving Day. You're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. News headlines from NPR are next, and then in the WPR newscast, a Wisconsin researcher is concerned about declining wild potato species. WPR's Chuck Kornbach brings us more coming up in just a few minutes.
XM, the first call letters of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's only fitting that this is the name of our circle of leadership supporters who give $100 a month or more to ensure WPR continues well into the future. Join the 9XM Leadership Circle today with your gift of $100 a month or more. Your gift makes everything we do at WPR possible today and in the days to come. Go to WPR.org and click donate. Thank you.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump is giving thanks to the U.S. military on this Thanksgiving holiday.
As we give thanks for this holiday, I know I speak on behalf of all Americans when I say that we totally support you. In fact, we love you. We really do. We love you.
That's the president speaking from Florida, where he's spending the holiday at his Mar-a-Lago resort. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
President Trump's trip coincides with the beginning of the social season in the exclusive Florida enclave. Because of controversial comments he made after neo-Nazi and white supremacist rallies in Charlottesville, more than 20 charities canceled plans to hold fundraisers at Mar-a-Lago. Mar-a-Lago is still hosting many private parties and weddings. This is President Trump's eighth visit to the private club since taking office.
In Zimbabwe, there's word the country's former president, Robert Mugabe, has been granted immunity from prosecution as part of a deal that brought about his resignation. NPR's Afebia Quist-Arkton says his successor is preparing to take office tomorrow.
Zimbabwe is now preparing to swear in a new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa. He is the vice president who was booted out by Robert Mugabe 2 weeks ago. He has now returned to the country. He's pledging to unify Zimbabwe and create jobs.
Mugabe is 93. He ruled Zimbabwe for 37 years. There's no trading today on Wall Street because of the holiday. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
This is Wisconsin Public Radio News at 8:43. I'm Rachel Vasquez. As potatoes are being prepared for many holiday dinners this week, a Wisconsin researcher says he's concerned about a decline in wild potato species. Chuck Kornbach reports.
UW-Madison horticulture professor David Spooner has been collecting wild and domesticated potato specimens for about 30 years. He says when it comes to diversity, there's bad news and good news.
Clearly, the diversity of potato on the market shelf is not decreasing. One potential issue is the diversity of wild potatoes because of habitat destruction.
Spooner says part of his work at the UW and for the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been to put the potato specimens in a gene bank in Sturgeon Bay to preserve them for potato breeders. Spooner's now helping transfer more than 15,000 pressed plant specimens from the gene bank and his office to the state herbarium in Madison. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
A conservation club in northwestern Wisconsin says it will mount an albino deer accidentally shot by a hunter and use it as a teaching tool. The State Department of Natural Resources says the hunter who mistakenly shot the white deer contacted authorities after learning he had killed a protected animal in Pepin County. Conservation Warden Richard Rosen says even though the deer's head was partly brown, it was still protected. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security. More information is available at Cigna.com. From the Craig Newmark Foundation, committed to the values of fairness, opportunity, and respect, the Newmark Foundation supports veterans and military families, voting rights, truth in journalism, and women in tech. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noelle King.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Noelle is hosting the program for the first time. So why don't you just tell people, what's your day job?
My day job is covering economics for the Planet Money podcast.
The Planet Money podcast, and of course Planet Money does stories here on Morning Edition like this next one. Why don't you introduce
this one? Coming up. Okay, so Steve, this story is about two giant retailers that are competing for your grocery money.
Mm-hmm.
This past spring, you remember, Amazon bought Whole Foods, and their big competitor, Walmart, got a little worried and is now inventing new foods to compete. They're doing this, Walmart is doing this in a lab in Bentonville, Arkansas, and my colleague Julia DeWitt went out there.
When I got to Bentonville, I wasn't quite sure what to expect. Walmart has historically been a pretty secretive company. So going down, I'm wondering, will the offices be ringed in high walls? Will I be met with stony-faced security guards when I walked in?
So good to meet you in person.
Nice to meet you. Thanks for being here. I know it's a trek.
Yeah.
This is Molly Blakeman. She is basically the opposite of cold and secretive. We walk back through this compound, and eventually I end up in a room with this guy, Jack Pastello. In front of us, on a plate, is one of Walmart's newest food developments.
It is a bright red pickle.
Yes, a bright red pickle.
And it's got a lot of fruit punch loaded in it. As you get, you pickle it with fruit punch.
Walmart would like the world to know it is creating tropical fruit punch pickles. They call this the tropical. Naturally, I have to try it.
Okay. I think I can probably just cut it with this fork. I'm not sure. I'm your prime consumer for this. Wow, this tastes crazy.
But it does taste like tropical punch, doesn't it? It's like the texture.
It sure does.
It is both ridiculously sweet and still tastes like a sour, salty pickle. This place I'm in is called the Culinary and Innovation Center. Walmart built it last year as part of an effort to up their food game, because Walmart is inventing food. The tropical was inspired by a kind of pickle you can find in barbecue joints in the South. Other things that have been developed here include birthday cake oatmeal, and they're even developing new kinds of fruits and vegetables.
This watermelon is actually yellow-skinned and striped, and they're bright red inside, and the flavor is unbelievable.
This is Victor Verlage. He's helping develop all new produce for the company. He says the yellow color, it was actually an accident, but it will also give them a competitive edge. And while I'm looking at it, it occurs to me, this yellow watermelon may be exactly the kind of weapon they'll need in this food fight with Amazon.
When a piece of fruit or vegetable looks odd at first, you know, people really have to try hard, you know, to get to taste it. But if we put demos in the stores and they love it, then that becomes your best friend, because your kid will tell you, Mommy, bring me the yellow watermelon that I love. Easy to recognize.
Food is the one thing we absolutely need all of the time, and it brings us into stores more regularly than anything else we buy. Walmart and Amazon, they both know this. Furthermore, that yellow watermelon, it is exclusively found at Walmart. And when that mom goes to Walmart for that melon, she might remember she needs some socks and some detergent. And while she's at it, well, pretty much everything else she might need. Julia DeWitt, NPR News.
Support for Planet Money comes from Fidelity Investments, taking a personalized approach to helping clients grow, preserve, and manage their wealth. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC.
This is NPR News.
It is 10 minutes before 9 o'clock, and classical music starts in 15 minutes here on WPR. And still to come on Morning Edition, we'll hear about what songs to listen to when you're dealing with a stressful Thanksgiving. NPR's Rachel Martin talks to music commentator Miles Hoffman coming up in just a few minutes.
On the Thanksgiving edition of Fresh Air, something entertaining for the holiday, we listen back to my recent interview with Jimmy Fallon. We talked about hosting The Tonight Show, his early comedy, and lots more. I hope you'll join us, and I hope you have a great holiday.
It should be a sunny Thanksgiving day across Wisconsin with some light winds throughout the day. Highs will be in the low 30s to mid 40s. And tonight it should be mostly clear with some clouds and a chance for showers in northwest Wisconsin. Lows will be in the low 30s and mid 40s. Tomorrow it will be another sunny day with highs in the 50s and 40s in the northwest. This is WPR.
Support for WPR comes from Steep & Brew, a Wisconsin coffee roaster dedicated to delivering truly fresh, premium coffee to local grocers. Coffee roasted today is delivered within 72 hours. Steep & Brew, coffee done right. More at steepandbrew.com.
Support for WGTD comes from Carthage College, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. More information is available online at carthage.edu/grad.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Noelle King, and it is Thanksgiving, a day to be thankful. But look, between the anxiety over cooking the perfect dinner and those weird, awkward political conversations with relatives, Thanksgiving can be stressful. But Morning Edition co-host Rachel Martin discovered that the stress of the holidays is not so bad if you just add a little music.
If the perfect Thanksgiving could be expressed in music, it might sound like this. This piece is Mourning by Edvard Grieg. It's from his Peer Gynt suite. It is peaceful, it is soothing, and probably the exact opposite of how your Thanksgiving day is going to go. Here with a musical guide to the emotional cornucopia known as Thanksgiving is musical commentator Miles Hoffman. Hey, Miles.
Hello, Rachel. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I am ready to have you dish up some musical antidotes to Thanksgiving stress. So, with that in mind, here's the deal. I'm going to present a few holiday-related scenarios. You're going to come up with some classical music that captures those moments.
Yeah, so accompaniments, maybe not antidote. I don't know if we're going to... I don't know if I'll be successful with antidotes. I won't fix anything, no.
All right, so let's start off with the following situation. It's about 45 minutes before your guests are going to arrive. You are still in your pajamas. The food is not nearly ready. What's a good piece of music that seems to fit that moment?
Okay, and the cranberry salad, you forgot to take it out of the refrigerator.
Oh, yeah, it's not even made. I didn't even assemble that yet.
All right, here's some good music for that.
Frantic, maniacal, that about does it. Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's from Sergei Prokofiev's ballet Romeo and Juliet, Rich. I feel a little guilty using it because it really doesn't end well. All that scurrying around is, in fact, a duel scene. It's a sword fight, and it ends with the death of Tybalt.
Oh, yeah, that does not portend good things.
No. I can also tell you that it's very hard to play. Prokofiev, I don't know what he was like in the kitchen, but he made life difficult sometimes for orchestra players.
All right, so let us just assume, for the sake of this game, that all the major disasters in the kitchen have been averted. Nothing has burned. The guests show up. Mm-hmm. But... what happens when one of those guests is your Uncle Hal,
the relative in your family who always has just the wrong thing to say at the wrong time. But of course, you got to invite him because he's your Uncle Hal. He's part of your family.
Well, I think that what we need to hear is the most famous acceptance of a dinner invitation by an unwelcome guest in the history of music. This is from the final scene of Mozart's opera Don Giovanni. Mm. And the Don is hosting a big dinner, and a stone statue from the other world shows up.
Yeah.
It's the terrifying stone guest, the statue of a man Don Giovanni killed at the beginning of the opera. Oh. The statue shows up, and he sings, "Don Giovanni, you invited me to dinner, and I have come."
Don Giovanni,
that is going to be an awkward dinner. So, Uncle Hal, he has arrived. He's at the table. And, of course, he starts talking about politics. Maybe a little religion thrown in just to get things
really complicated. Oh, my goodness. Politics and religion.
Yeah, double whammy.
Yeah.
What's the musical choice now?
More Mozart, Rachel. This is from the finale of Act Two of Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro. And in this scene, six people are all singing at the same time. They're singing different words over or under one another, and they're all either angry or frightened or confused or loudly self-congratulatory. Only Mozart could have pulled this off.
Of the family discussion over Thanksgiving.
And it is kind of a family discussion. And the good news is at the end of the opera, everything ends happily. So that's
thank goodness. All right. Yeah. So if everything has ended happily, or at least you've agreed to disagree,
right,
you
got
to eat, right? Let's move on to the main event.
Okay.
The moment the turkey is revealed to the table. It's a dramatic moment. You got anything for that?
The dramatic presentation of the turkey.
Right. That better be a dang good turkey.
And actually, it would be even better if it were a Ukrainian turkey, because that's the Great Gate of Kiev from Modest Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. But I think the music is entirely appropriate in a foul kind of way, because the music that leads into the Great Gate, or the Great Turkey in this case, is the end of the section of the piece called The Hut on Chicken Legs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's foul.
So that's foul. There you go. You did it twice. Okay.
Sorry.
So despite the bad jokes, the bad puns, I'm still grateful for you, Miles. And it is the season of thanks and Thanksgiving.
Okay.
So to round out this conversation, what you got that gives us a sense of thanks and gratitude?
Well, the most beautiful thank you I know, Rachel, is actually a thank you to music itself. This is Fritz Wunderlich, the great tenor Fritz Wunderlich, singing Franz Schubert's An die Musik, to music. And the final words are, "Often has a sigh flowing out from your harp, a sweet divine harmony from you, unlocked to me the heaven of better times. You noble art, I thank you for it. You noble art, I thank you."
Musical Thanksgiving tribute. Miles, I am thankful for you, and I hope you have a lovely Thanksgiving.
It's entirely mutual, Rachel, and you too, and you and yours.
Miles Hoffman is the founder and violist of the American Chamber Players and the distinguished visiting professor of chamber music at the Schwab School of Music in Columbus, Georgia.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Noel King.
And I'm Stephen Skeep.
You can hear Morning Edition from 5 to 9 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. And to follow news throughout the day, visit WPR.org. There you can check out statewide news reports from WPR's award-winning news team, plus national and global headlines from NPR. It is a minute before 9 o'clock. Stay with us. Headlines and music are coming up next.
Support for WPR comes from Oakwood Village, Prairie Ridge, dedicated to building community, announcing their campus expansion, growing to serve the Madison area. Information on the expansion is available at oakwoodvillage.net.
WGTD is on your smartphone. For local news and the rest of the mobile version of our website, log on to WGTD.org. For live audio streams of WGTD, 24/7 Jazz HD2, and Sports Web, visit the App Store and download the free WGTD app.